Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Our guest this week is Olga Kazan, a staff writer at The Atlantic and author of the new book, Weird. Hey, Olga, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. I'm doing well.
Yes, it's really great to meet you and to have another writer on the other end of the line. And we're really looking forward to what you find interesting these days in the tool world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so your first tool is one that I have used to write more than one book myself. It's called Scrivener. And tell us what Scrivener is and why you use it.
Yeah, Scrivener is the tool that I use to write my book as well. And it's just this really great software for writing long articles or books. I would say that the best thing about it is that it allows you to kind of like stick everything in a little mini file and move it around really freely without having to commit to like copy and pasting things, which I guess for me, like a big mental block was always just like, I want to revise this book, but I don't want to copy and paste too much because I'm worried I'll like lose my place or lose a big chunk of text. But with Scrivener, you can kind of like dump everything in there and like rearrange it really easily. And it just holds everything really nicely. You can have notes off to the side. It's like made specifically with all the like neuroses and problems that writers have in mind.
Yeah. It's a great catch-all for like,
right. It sort of works by understanding that you're just going to have a million little pieces. They may be paragraphs. There may be a chapter. There may be a side note, a footnote, and all those little millions of pieces you can kind of rearrange at will in whatever way you want. And maybe even more than one way. And nothing is fixed, and so you can just kind of output a book at the end just by having it string together the pieces in the order that you want them to.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. And I found that like very, very helpful and almost like game changing.
Yeah, and Kevin, it even has kind of like Stuart Brand's idea of like rearranging index cards. It actually has like an index card view. And then you right. can like just kind of move things around and have one idea per card that represents some underlying or attached text to it.
Right. It even has a skeuomorphic view of an actual bulletin corkboard where you can put the cards on if that is helpful to you. But it does, that is, seems to be the unit is a card, a little 3x5 card that is sort of the notational idea of that little hunk, and you can kind of move cards around and put them in order and change the orders and reuse the same card in different order and so forth. So it's really very, very powerful in that way.
Olga, did you use it to store your audio like interviews as well?
No, I didn't. I kept all my research in Evernote and then just Dropbox. And I kind of had three programs running all the time in addition to like Twitter. I don't know. I never really got into storing my research in there. I might experiment that with like future projects, but I just found the actual interface and the actual that ability to move things around really easily, to take like snapshots and roll back to previous versions that you had really easily. I found that to be like a huge plus.
Mm-hmm. And so you said you did your research in Evernote. That is like web research, or was other kind of research also going into Evernote?
That was just web research. And then, I just use Dropbox a lot. I find the like, I don't know, I'm a child of the 90s. So I find like folders really comforting. I don't know. It's just like very like nice for me to like, so I have like a folder of all my studies and a folder of all my interviews and things like that. And that's mostly what I use.
So Olga, this is a problem I have because I use Dropbox and Evernote and Scrivener and stuff, and sometimes and also Google Drive. And there's a lot of times when I'll like not remember where I stored something. Do you use certain of these like cloud storage things for certain kinds of data, or are you like me and just kind of like not very organized about it.
No, I've definitely had that problem where I forget where something is stored. And especially like if I make a Google Doc, it's hard to remember if it was in a Google Doc or as a Word document in my Dropbox. Mm-hmm. I do not have a solution to that yet. My solution so far has been to just try to like search Google Drive if I can't find something and see if I made a Google Doc of it. But I know that that's like not very elegant. So I'm looking forward to trying to find a solution to that.
I have exactly the same problem. Just last week, I wasted, I don't know, way too much time trying to find something because I couldn't remember if I had it in Google or on a Word doc or somewhere else. And that kind of Uber overall umbrella search is the tool I'm waiting for.
Yes. Yeah, I know. That'd be great. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
That would be a valuable product, Kevin. Some kind of search thing that searches all of your cloud storage right. services at once.
Yeah, I'm surprised.
And then makes it invisible to you so that you just don't even need to worry about where it is.
I'm surprised Google hasn't done that yet.
I know.
That's their mandate, right?
Yeah, definitely. Well, okay, so Scrivener, and then you use it to write your book. We'll talk about your book a little bit later. Tell us about the New York Times cooking app.
Oh, yeah. I guess this is another one that's not exactly hidden, but I just use this so much. I find it's like basically the only thing I use. I have a ton of cookbooks that I never crack open these days because I'm just always in the New York Times cooking app. I just think it's so easy to search for like whatever you have that's, you know, about to go bad or like you really need to cook. You know, like if you have like fennel or something, it'll pull up a bunch of great recipes. They're really easy to follow. They have like comments where people have like, you know, modified them or done them to great success. And, you know, you can kind of follow along. The pictures are really nice. And you can like save them to like a personal file. So you always can know what you actually enjoyed versus like just trying something new every time.
So I'm not familiar with this. And so is this something that runs on your phone? Is it something that runs, on all the platforms and iPads, and is that what it is primarily? And are these recipes from the New York Times? Are these additional to the ones that have appeared in the Times?
Yeah, so these are all New York Times recipes, and it actually runs on anything. It can be on your phone or on your computer or iPad. I mostly do it on my phone because I just have my phone on my like kitchen counter while I'm cooking. But right now, and like one nice thing is that they'll go through and like suggest other recipes based on stuff that you've liked in the past. So it suggests like a lot of bean stuff for me, cause I guess I make a lot of things out of beans. If you're like more of a steak lover, they'll like give you more of that stuff. So I just find it like such a great tool just to make like cooking really easy after work. If you don't want to mess around with like a big, you know, production.
So you can just enter the ingredients that you have on hand and it will like find recipes that include all of those ingredients.
I don't know if it's that sophisticated. I have to admit that like the search is not like my most favorite element of it. But I just typed in fennel because we were using that example and it gave me like a bunch of things with fennel in them as like a primary ingredient. And then it like highlights the ones that I've already saved or liked so that if I can kind of go back to my classic fennel standbys if I want. It's just been like, I've tried every other thing, like meal planning apps and like different recipe blogs and different cookbooks, like I said, but nothing works quite as well as the cooking app.
And is this because of its interface or because of its content or both?
You know, I actually think the interface is what's really good. I mean, some of the recipes are not that innovative, I would say. They pretty much dumped all the New York Times like recipes ever into it. So, you know, you have like stuff from the 70s that's like a little bit not very modern and a little bit strange. But like, I actually think just the interface is like very easy to follow. It like can switch from, reading the recipe to actually cooking the recipe. It gives you like reviews of them and like star ratings. It's just like really pretty much, you can add to your grocery list from it. It's just like very handy.
Okay.
Is it included in a New York Times digital subscription, or is it a standalone product? Or
I was very worried that you were going to ask me this, and the answer is that I do not know. I am pretty sure I pay for this separately, and I have just lost track. because I pay for the New York Times, and I think I also pay for this. I don't think it's included, but I'm actually not sure.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, I pay for the New York Times, and so I'm just looking at it. It knows that I'm logged in, but it is also saying that I have a 28-day free trial to the cooking app. So I imagine that it's a separate fee.
Yes. To have,
just like the crossword puzzle, which my wife pays for as separately.
Yes.
They charge you for every little thing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I kind of sometimes wish I could just like pay the New York Times half my paycheck and like just have like all you can eat access to all of its stuff, but that's exactly. Not how it works.
Yeah.
Okay. And how much, so Mark, how much was it as an extra?
$40 a year. 40 a year if you pay for it annually.
Okay. All right.
New York Times, subscribe to New York Times cooking. So it's its own thing. Okay, well, that looks like a very cool one. And I should probably get that one because we have like four recipes that we just run through over here.
You may get a fifth one out of here, and that's worth it,
yeah,
right?
That's it. Yeah, we'll be good. So, okay, this is great because we get recommendations for noise-canceling headphones from people, but this is one we haven't heard of, the Sony model.
Yeah. So these are just, I forget how I heard about these. I guess my boyfriend got a pair and then I also got a pair because I really liked how they looked. I don't know if the sound quality is that good because I'm not like an audiophile. I just want it to be really, really quiet and to play my like ambient like work music in a like a normal way. And these work really great for that. Like I feel like the charge lasts a really long time. They look nice. They're like they kind of like fit over your ear nicely and they're really comfortable to wear all day.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's like the killer thing for me is usually headphones hurt my ears. My friend had a pair of they're called Odyssey, spelled like Audible, kind of Odyssey, and they're like $2,500 headphones, and they're the only like over-the-ear headphones that I could wear for hours on end without hurting my ears after like 2 hours.
Yeah. So I had that problem because I wear glasses, so like pretty much anything that sits right on my ear like starts to hurt my head after like an hour. But I've been able to wear these all day and without a problem. And what's really cool is you can put your hand over them and they'll switch out of the noise canceling mode. And you can just hear everything around you, which is kind of neat. You don't have to pull them off your head.
And have you compared them to, say, like the Bose ones, the very expensive Bose noise canceling ones?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I've definitely worn the Bose, but I feel like I've never had them both at the same time, so I don't know if the, like I said, I'm not like actually sure about the sound quality. But I do also have like an old pair of Bose wired noise canceling headphones, like, so they're not Bluetooth. And those also work really well, but you have to, you know, it's like you have to plug them in, so you can't do them with like pretty much any iPhone these days, where you have to have an adapter. So in that way, they're like more annoying. So that kind of cancels out some of the benefit.
and these, I forgot, are these Bluetooth or they are wired?
They're Bluetooth.
Okay. And have you tried the earbud versions of the noise canceling? Is that something that works for you?
Yeah. So I had a pair of my very first pair of noise canceling headphones were the kind that go in your ear. And I felt like they were fine, but they just didn't really cancel a lot of noise. Like you could still pretty much hear, you know, the plane taking off and like all the, you know, your coworkers talking and all that stuff. So I was like, I mean, like it was, they worked well, and they were also kind of weirdly bulky. They had a little box on the cord leading down from your head, which was just like kind of awkward and like didn't look very good to have like a box dangling from your face. Yeah.
And how much are these Sony headphones?
They're expensive. So they're $300 off the Sony website. I don't know if like people can get deals or something to bring down the cost, or you know, if they sometimes go on sale or something. But that's pretty much what I've seen them out there for.
Okay. Let's see. Yeah. I think I don't know if they're available. Oh yeah, $278 on Amazon, so you don't get much of a break.
Right. Yeah.
I will say that these kinds of Bluetooth noise canceling headphones have become pretty cheap, and you can get decent ones. I bought my daughter's some battery power, you know, rechargeable wireless Bluetooth noise canceling headphones for a long flight to Singapore over Christmas break, and they love them, and they're like constantly using them now too. And they actually, I can't really tell the difference between them and the Bose wired old pair that I have. And so if you, I think that, you know, the technology has gotten to the point where it's become a commodity in a lot of cases. And so even cheap ones are really good now.
Yeah, they may not be as good as, say, the Sony Bose, but they're probably like, you know, still better than they were, you know, 5 years ago or even 2 years ago.
I think so.
Yeah.
And the prices have just plummeted on them.
Right. So you have another tool for us with your desk job.
Yes. So I have always had back pain. Like my back, I just like lived with it always hurting. I guess it was before I started writing my book, actually. I decided to invest in like a really nice chair for my like home desk. And I got the Steelcase Leap chair after doing all this research. And it's worked out great. It like completely has stopped my back from hurting, and I can like sit all day like it's nothing. So yeah, it's been wonderful.
And this is the kind of chair where you can kind of adjust it in like, you know, 100 different dimensions so it can really fit your form. Is that the idea of the Leap chair?
You know, I don't even think that is. So with the Leap, not really. It's not actually that all that adjustable. There's a Steelcase has another one called the Gesture Chair, which is maybe the one you're thinking of, which is like you can sit in it every which way and it's like so adjustable. That was honestly just like too much chair for me. Like I just kind of wanted something to sit in. But this one, it has some stuff like you can adjust the arms and the height and all that stuff. But really it's just like, somehow it's like so much more comfortable than those like, crappy, like office chairs that you normally get, you know, with your office job. So it's really been worth it for me just like to not be in pain all the time.
Yeah. And you think it's just the general ergonomic design of the chair as a whole that is really what is easing your pain sitting there all day then?
Yeah, like it doesn't like look like one of those executive office chairs with the big kind of bulky seat and the, you know, high back and the, you know, padded arms. Like you don't look like necessarily an executive. You're just like very comfortable. Like it has like nice lumbar support and it rolls and it like the seat is like was like big enough for you to like squirm around in all day and like not, you know, doesn't like keep you locked in one position. It's just been like really nice. I'm like, why didn't I do this sooner? Probably because it was too expensive.
It is a little expensive, but also one of the things I have noticed, because I went looking for one of these recently, is that there are a lot of used ones, at least in Silicon Valley, when companies go out of business, and they're kind of like they have a lot of them to move, and they're not even that used. Lots of times startups fail, and they've all got these chairs, and you can get good bargains on a hardly used Leap chair from a startup that flamed out. So do check Craigslist.
I mean, I'm sure you guys probably in the Bay Area have like more used nice office chairs than us like government job people in DC where they don't have nice office chairs to begin with, so it's pointless to look. I mean, if you could get it used, I would totally recommend that. I would have done that, except there just weren't any in my area.
Okay. Yeah, I went down to one guy. He had like hundreds of them just waiting to go.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember when John Battelle's publishing company, Industry Standard. They had an office here in LA, and it was just loaded with brand new Aeron chairs. And they hadn't even staffed up the office yet. And there were like 50 Aeron chairs. And then like about 2 weeks later, they declared bankruptcy. I'm sure those things went for fire sale prices.
Right.
In the remaining time we have, you have a new book, which should be out within days of when this podcast will run. It's called Weird. And it is kind of based on your own personal experience about being a Russian immigrant moving to Texas. Tell us about the book and kind of what you learned about the science of nonconformity.
Yeah. So this is a book that was kind of like the spark for it was the fact that I grew up as a Russian immigrant in Texas, first in West Texas and then in a suburb of Dallas. And I kind of like always lived with this feeling like, well, growing up, I definitely felt this way. Like I'm totally different from everyone else and I completely don't fit in. Had a lot of trouble making friends. And it kind of was this like feeling that I carried forward in my life a little bit where I noticed that in a lot of situations, I felt like a needlessly insecure or just like, I'm never gonna get into this group or this job or this, you know, whatever else that I wanted, because I'm not like everyone else in this, environment. So I kind of, decided to start looking into kind of both the science behind this feeling of like being an outsider. And also I just wanted to interview other people who felt the same way and kind of see how they, dealt with it, which is like one of the perks of journalism is to just like solve your problems by interviewing people. And it was really fun. I met a lot of really interesting people, like a female race car driver, this really liberal professor living in this the most conservative place in America, this male preschool teacher. A lot of folks who are kind of dealing with being like this total sore thumb in their environment and kind of talk to them about how they dealt with it and what was kind of good and sometimes not so good about it.
So you have a bunch of vignettes or stories about each person. And do you, over the time or at the end, try to extract some general principle or insight or something they all have in common?
Yeah. So they don't all have like one thing in common, but I would say the most successful ones have found a way of dealing with their struggles and with the kind of some of the issues of being kind of an oddball brings with it. So one of my favorite people that I met was actually another Russian immigrant in Texas, who came as a teenager and was just had it much worse than me. Her mom was a mail order bride. She didn't speak English when she came, and she was, you know, pretty much had graduated from high school, so she had to kind of start all over again and learn English and go to college and kind of deal with the stigma of having her background. So one thing that I noticed that people like her that she did and people like her did was kind of try to look at things from the big picture. Like they kind of like they don't personalize everything. Like everything to them like kind of almost looks like a math problem or like this they have a tendency to kind of like observe their life from afar, which I find really difficult to do, but is it's actually like science backed. Like people, like researchers have found that if you have a problem and you just refer to yourself in the third person, for example, that can actually be really helpful in helping you solve the problem.
Cool.
So it's a kind of a detachment of some level, a
healthy detachment. Right. Yeah. Not caring what happens to you, but just being like sort of being able to see like a bigger picture perspective.
How old were you when you immigrated?
Yeah. So I was three. So I was really young. I almost like didn't have it as, whatever bad or like severely as some of the folks in my book did.
Yeah. My mother was born in the United States, but her parents emigrated from Russia. And so she didn't speak any English when she was a kid. And then she was just like thrown into first grade, not knowing any English. And it was like really difficult for her to kind of have that experience. And I think that kind of affected her much in the same way. I think she would really enjoy this book.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of folks who are, you know, immigrants who I think feel that way. Or just like, I don't know, I notice that like anytime, like journalists on Twitter are always talking about like, oh, I'm so awkward. Like, you know, I don't know. I feel like it's like a profession of awkward people. Yeah.
So are you in the book, do you kind of take the stance that nonconformity is sort of seen as maybe like a handicap that people are trying to overcome? Or is it more like the Silicon Valley kind of view that you want to cultivate your nonconformity in order to think of something that other people won't?
Oh, or interesting.
Both.
I would say these folks mostly don't cultivate their nonconformity just because it's kind of foisted upon them. Like they, like this professor just happened to get a job in sociology in the most conservative place, right? Or like this woman just happened to really like race car driving, which is a male profession. But I would say they like in some cases try to find ways to use their nonconformity as a strength. They're like a selling point in some cases, especially in the case of the race car driver.
Because there is sort of like, I mean, I'm going to make up a term, a voluntary nonconformity. And that's people, you know, kind of almost contrarianism. Like you have a people like someone like that, Peter Thiel, which is just by habit, he's going to try nonconform as a strategy. And so I was just wondering whether you countered people who adopted that as a kind of a strategy for the life of trying not to conform.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think like one reason why, and I talk about this in the book, but like Silicon Valley has that and people like Peter Thiel, like, you know, do what they do and advocate, you know, drinking young blood or whatever it is that they're doing, is there's like this concept of tight and loose cultures. This is the idea of like how open to nonconformity your environment is. It's a concept from sociology, but actually Silicon Valley is like one of the loosest cultures. It's actually like one of the few places, you know, startups and you know, places like that where people really do value nonconformity, and you're kind of looking for ways to like peacock a little bit and stand out from the crowd. So that could be why that's so valued there and why so many people do it. Of course, then it becomes, you know, conformity.
Yeah, you conform by being nonconforming. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, but break sure. free. Yeah.
Well, it's like, what was it? I don't know who said it, but you're unique, like, you know, like everybody else.
Right.
Yeah. Olga, where is the most conservative place in the country?
It's in Wichita Falls, Texas. And I used it's like the Cook Political Report or something. I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact name of it, but it's some rating where they see like how much more likely you are to vote Democratic or Republican than the average place. And so it's Wichita Falls, Texas, which is about 2 hours west of where my parents live.
And did you find, if you visited, I assume you visited there, did you find that it was, did it meet its reputation?
Yeah, so this is really, so I like decided to walk around and just, speaking of nonconformity, like ask random people what they thought about hot button social issues. So it was a kind of all over the map. Like some people said they weren't feminists for various reasons. Some people said they were feminists, but they didn't like, you know, transgender people using, you know, a certain bathroom. Some people seemed, you know, really hardcore conservative, but they were really into my name and thought it was really cool. I wouldn't say that I got, maybe I just hit a strange smattering of people, but I wouldn't say that it was, you know, like overwhelmingly conservative. Yeah.
And how did the professor, like, how did he make it work for him to live there?
Yeah. So it's a she, and it was really difficult for her. She thought about leaving for a while. She felt like her students, so she taught like the sociology of gender, and students were saying, this is like against my religion. Like, I'm not going to listen to you. I think like a couple of things made it easier for her. She, first, I think, students have just gotten more liberal over time. Like, there's even in Wichita Falls, like there's now like a lot of feminists on campus and things like that. And she also did this thing called idiosyncrasy credits, which is where you kind of, if you want people to be okay with your kind of crazy ideas, you have to like kind of introduce them to how normal you can be first. And so she kind of did that. Like, she started changing up her lesson plans instead of kind of telling people like, oh, feminism, it's, you know, it's really great and you should all, you know, be into it. She would kind of start out by saying, oh, you know, like, we're going to talk about men and masculinity. And then we're going to talk about makeup and like, who wears makeup in society? And she would kind of like ease them in almost like gradually into, you know, some of the more hardcore gender studies topics that might not sit as well in Wichita Falls. So that's a topic that's also, or that's a strategy that's also research backed.
Very cool. So does Weird have like lessons to like takeaways in it, or is it more like just narrative exposition?
Yeah, it does have takeaways. So two of the takeaways are things that I just talked about, the idiosyncrasy credits and the ability to look at things from an outsider perspective. But yeah, it has, so every person's kind of little narrative, in some cases, several people's lumped together, ends in kind of a way that folks who feel different in that way can maybe make their situation a little bit more tolerable.
That sounds great. So the book is called Weird, and the exact release date, I believe, is April 7th, right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, sounds good. And you can get it at your local bookstore or online. It'll be everywhere. Olga, thank you so much. This has been really fun talking to you.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on.
Hey, everybody. It's your host, Mark, and I wanted to thank you for listening to the Cool Tools Show. And I also wanted to let you know that we've got a lot more going on at Cool Tools than just this podcast. We also have the Cool Tools website, which has a new tool review every day, and you can get there by going to cool-tools.org. We also have 4 different newsletters that you can subscribe to, and you can subscribe to those from the Cool Tools page. We have this podcast that you're listening to right now. We also have a YouTube channel where we review tools. Check that YouTube channel out by going to youtube.com/cooltools. And one of the things I'd like to ask you is, if you're really enjoying everything that we are producing, go to our Patreon page and support us there. You can sign up and give us as little as $1 a month, and that would mean a lot to us. The money that we get from Patreon goes towards a lot of things. We transcribe our podcast interviews so that you can read them online. We pay for editing of our podcasts and for our videos. We pay our contributors. We have video production costs. We have equipment costs. We have hosting costs. And the money you give us through Patreon also goes to support Cool Tools Lab. Anything you give is a huge help. And one of the things that we do is, if you are a contributor to Patreon, we'll give you a shout out on air. And so I have a few people here to thank this week. Mark Lyonage, Micah Gates, Monty Zukowski, Patrick James McNally, Robert Cohen, Scott, Spence Lloyd, Steve Avery, Steve Golden, Steve Levine, Tom Hess, William Phillips, Aaron Nipper, Dharab Patel, Glenn Mercer, Jay Walker, Jeff Bonaire, Ryan Jarrell, Pat Daly, Patrick Kennedy, Troy Wallett, Mike Camerate, Nicole Harkin, Tim Youssef, Scott Reed. Thanks all of you for supporting Cool Tools. And if you would like to have a shout out, go over to the Patreon page and sign up. And thanks for listening to the Cool Tools podcast. We'll see you next week.